us.
Okay, I know probably all of you bar a couple, actually, which is nice. Okay, so what I would say is do please feel free to ask questions as I go along. I can't guarantee to answer them, but I'll do my best. And also, I mean, yes, certainly as some of you have got some programming experience, do please feel free to interject, correct, update, or whatever, as you see fit. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to firstly distinguish between two different types of programming languages, scripting languages and programming languages. And I'm going to talk about some of the characteristics of those two different programming languages. And then I'm going to actually look at what a programming language is, because if you're thinking about, you know, possibly going into programming, although, I mean, I think most of you are actually a little bit beyond that stage, it's worth actually telling you about the anatomy of a programming language. And that is actually a precursor to a talk I'm likely to be giving in October, which will either be called The Nuts and Bolts of Programming or The Anatomy of Programming, in which I'll kind of expand on that to talk about in more detail the different statements and different components that make up programming languages in a general sense. I'm thinking of using a cooking analogy for doing that. It seems to work fairly well for most of it. And then finally, I'll get on to talking about some specific languages, sort of delineating their differences and what they're used for, talking a bit specifically about mobile application development, and finally about accessible programming environments. I'd particularly value any contributions people can make about that, because obviously it's all very well talking about programming, but you know, it comes down to it, you need an environment that's actually usable to be able to do it. So please feel free, particularly at that point, to contribute your own experiences. So actually, when you start looking at programming languages per se, there are hundreds of them. In fact, there are hundreds of each of the two types of programming language that I'm going to talk about. Some of them are very specific for doing very particular types of job. Others are down to a particular manufacturer. For example, Oracle, who produced the world's leading relational database system, have a language that's specific to their database management system, DBMS, whereas other programming languages are very general purpose. Others are particularly good for web development and so on. So I mentioned that there are essentially two different types of programming language, and we can call it, although it's slightly confusing, I'm going to use what they're called in the literature. So I'm going to talk about general purpose programming languages and scripting languages. And the essential difference between them is that general purpose programming languages can run by themselves. And they can, in some cases, run on pretty much any operating system. For example, Java. If you write a program in Java, then you can run it on any machine, be it a Windows machine, an Apple Mac, on a VAC system, under Unix. So that's a particular characteristic of what I would call general purpose programming languages. Scripting languages, however, are tied to a particular environment. So they, for example, might be tied to a particular operating system, or they might be tied to particular browsers or a number of different browsers. So you can still do an awful lot with them, but what you can't do with a scripting language is develop a complete standalone application, because the way that the scripting language works is it needs an environment that supports it in order to be able to run the program. Generally speaking, scripting languages are easier to learn and easier to program. They tend to need less coding to achieve the same task than you would need in a general purpose programming language. The most obvious example of a general purpose programming language would be Java. As I mentioned, if you write a program in Java, you can run it on a Mac or on a Unix machine or on a Windows machine. And curiously, the most common, obviously common example of a scripting language would be JavaScript. JavaScript, although it's got the word Java in common with the programming language Java, is nothing like Java. Don't think they're likely to be similar because they've got the word Java in it. They're not. JavaScript is considerably easier to learn because it is a scripting language than Java, and they tend to be used, generally speaking, for different things. Another difference between programming languages in general, or general purpose programming languages and scripting languages, is that a program written in a scripting language will usually run slower than an equivalent program written in a general purpose programming language. The reason for that is that when you write a program in a general purpose programming language, you have to what's called compile it. And I know for sure some of you will know what that means. Basically, you need to run it through another program which converts it into a language that the computer can understand. Okay, essentially into binary code. Although there are slight exceptions to that. I mean, because this is essentially an introductory talk, many of the things I am saying are very broadly true, but there are exceptions.
Is that the point that you would turn it into a Windows or a Mac?
Yes, you would compile it for a particular target machine. Yes, yeah, that's right. Whereas with an interpreter, if you wrote the same, you know, a program that does the same thing in a scripting language, you don't have to compile it, but what happens is when you run it, the environment in which you run it actually interprets the code and converts it at that point into a form that can be executed. And so that process takes longer. And so a program written in a scripting language that does the same thing as a program written as a general purpose programming language, the scripting language version will take longer. But with the general purpose programming language, you had this compile step that you have to go through beforehand. Okay, having said that, because of modern hardware, the difference between how long a scripting language program takes to execute and a general purpose programming language takes to execute has become much smaller and less significant, unless you're talking about really high performance applications. Okay, so some features that I want to talk about, kind of the anatomy of programming languages in general then now, before I go on to talk about specific languages. So forgive me, those of you that have actually done a bit of programming. This is to give those people who haven't a feel for what makes up a typical programming language. And I'm doing this in sort of quite general terms, so it's not language specific. What I'm about to say is true about pretty much all programming languages, be it a general purpose language or a scripting language. So they usually have a statement that tells the machine or whatever's executing it, the device or whatever, that it's the beginning of the program. And it very often is the word begin. And then there's a statement that will say to the environment that's executing it, this is the end of a program. Then fairly self-evidently, you need statements that can read in data. They quite often are read statements as it happens, but they might be input statements. They may, you know, the way you might tell a computer this is one of them, it will either be a read statement or maybe an input statement. And similarly, you need, in the same way, you know, you're putting data in, you're hopefully getting useful information out, so you need statements to print information or write information out to the screen, if that's what you're using, or to the printer, or if it's a graphics program, to a plotter or whatever device you want to send the output to. Then you need what are called variables. Variables are things that store specific bits of information. So, for example, if I wanted to store the value of pi, 3.14159, then I need to allocate that to something. So if I actually decide to call it a variable called pi in the program, then I would probably have a statement somewhere which says, this variable pi equals 3.1459. And in some languages, I would have had to have declared that variable first as a real number. A real number in computer coding terms is a number that isn't an integer. In other words, that's got something after the decimal point. Okay, so like 3.1415 and so on. Whereas if it's just an integer, you would actually specify to the program that it's an integer. So you'd say if you want something that's going to hold numbers like, round numbers like 10, 20, 30, then you might call it a variable called integer holder, and you would declare it as of type integer, because that's the type of information it's going to hold.
Why do you need to differentiate between them at all?
Because in some languages you don't, actually. But in languages where you do, it's so that the environment that's executing the statements knows how to handle the arithmetic. Basically, it knows that it's adding a real number to an integer number. In a language like Python, I'm fairly sure you don't have to do that. But in languages like C or C++, then you do. And I'll get into that kind of thing more shortly when I start talking about individual languages.
Yeah, there's one point that I can pick up. It's to say the reason why you have typing is that you could, for instance, say, I have a type called room, which might have some different elements to it. That is a type, so you want to say, I have this variable called rose room of type room, which has lights, has walls, things like that. That's one element for typing. The other element which comes in is associated with how much space is required on the computer. So a floating point number has a much larger amount of space required to be stored, whereas an integer is typically much smaller, so hence it takes up much less space. Does that help, Tony?
Yes, it does. Yeah. Thank you. So those are variables which essentially hold single kind of bits of information, like the value of pi or some counter or something like that. Then you need statements to assign values to these variables. In other words, to put some value into these variables, which are kind of containers for information. So you need... They're called assignment statements. So you say, let pi equals 3.14159 or whatever. So, you can actually say then that value pi has that value. And if you want to multiply something by that value of pi, you can say some other variable, say r, is multiplied by pi. And if you wanted to assign that to a result, say to be stored in a variable s, you might have you might be able to say S equals R times pi. Okay, so that would whatever value is stored in variable R, it will multiply that by pi and store it in the variable S.
I think actually a pi is a constant rather than a variable.
Yes, you could. Yes, absolutely, you could do. Yeah, you
so
could.
I would say I have something called a diameter, which is R times pi.
Yeah, exactly. So you essentially the thing to understand is that you have these variables or indeed constant values if it's something like pi that never changes, where you can store bits of information, and you need mathematical operators such as plus, minus, times, and divide, so that you can carry out operations on those variables. And pretty much all languages will support, you know, those basic four mathematical operators, plus, minus, multiply, divide, but they'll also support more complicated mathematical operators, like taking the log value or the log to base 10 or the log to base whatever of a value, or taking the sine or the cosine or the tangent of a value. So, you know, it's not just necessarily the basic mathematical operators, but some languages support some quite sophisticated mathematical operators built in. Okay, so those, if you like, are some of the most sort of basic statements you have in languages. And then you get onto some of the slightly more interesting things that you commonly need to do in a computer program. So something that you often need to do is to repeat things a number of times. So trying to think of a quick example. If you wanted to keep adding values that you were reading in to a program, then what you might do is you might have a what's called a loop that keeps going round and round and reading in a value and adding it to the total. So what you might do is before the loop starts, you set your total to zero, and then you have a statement that says, right, we're gonna loop, we're gonna do something time and time again. And then at the start of the loop, you read in a new value that maybe the user types into the terminal. So you read in some value, say A, and then you say that in the next statement, you say total equals total, which started out as zero, plus A. So you add in the value that the user's just typed in into this value of total. And then the statement that you would have after that would be to say next iteration. And what that would do is go back to the beginning of the loop. And remember, the first statement in the loop was to read in a value from the user. So it would go back to the user, ask them to put in a new value. So they put in a new value for the variable A. And then the program would come to this statement again, total equals total, which will be, you know, the total from the last iteration of the loop, plus A. So it'll gradually keep going round and round, prompting the user for values, which will get added, in this case, to this total. And then at the end of that, you will have the end of the loop. And what the looping mechanism also has to do, obviously, is have some mechanism to say, well, how many times are you gonna go around doing this? Are you gonna loop around 100 times, or are you gonna maybe loop around until the user types in a negative value or types in zero? You know, you need to have some way of terminating the loop. But I've just used that as a simple example to explain something that you very, very often need to do in programming, and that's to repeat the same number of steps multiple times. And so looping, they're almost always in a language, the mechanism to loop around, to do the same thing over and over again. And you know, there may be many, many statements within a loop. You know, I've just given you an example of reading in a statement and then adding it to a total. But there might be hundreds of statements in that loop. It may do a lot of very complicated processing and then go around again and do the same lot of processing, but on a different set of data. Okay, so it's quite a powerful mechanism, looping. Another type of statement that's very common in computer languages is a conditional statement or if statement. So these are used to test particular situations. So if, for example, in that loop that I just described, if it wants to terminate when the user types in a value. So what we do, if you remember, we say we read in the value of A when we're first going through the loop, when as the first statement in the loop. And if we then put in, this will be actually terrible programming style, I might say, but if you then had a statement which said, if A is less than zero, go to the beyond the end of the loop, then effectively that would terminate the loop as soon as the user typed in a negative value. So this business of testing the value and then taking an action depending on the value that you've tested is, again, a very, very common situation in computing. And so we usually talk about if-then statements. In other words, if something is true, then go and do this. And then another variant on that is an if-then-else statement, which effectively says, if something is true, then go and do this, else, or in other words, if it's not true, go and do something else. So that's a very common construct in almost all computing languages.
Do you run that with an end if?
Yes, yeah, of course. Most commonly, if you've got a block of statements where you want to test a number of things, then you might use an end if statement. Then the final thing I want to just briefly mention in terms of common statements in languages, but it is a very powerful mechanism, is the ability to call other programs, or often they're called procedures. Okay, so if you've got a big program, if you've got a big problem to solve, you know, it's impossible as a programmer to kind of tackle it in one go. It's mentally just too demanding. So a very common approach in programming to solving problems is to break them down into smaller problems and tackle them one by one. And then you have a kind of master program which, you know, supposing you're going to solve this problem as a series of steps. So you're going to have step one, step two, step three, say. So you have a master program, which will do some setup, like setting up some variables, and then it'll call program to execute step one of the solution. So it'll call another program which solves the first part of the problem, and then it'll return to the master program, which will then call the program that solves step two of the problem, that sorts out step two of the problem. And then that'll return to the master program, and which will then call step three. That'll return, and then maybe the master program will print out the final result. Or, you know, if step three did that itself, then the master program may just terminate, may just end. And this is how human beings cope with very complicated software generally, well, it's one way, actually, that they cope with very complicated software by breaking down the problem, it's divide and conquer. In other words, just like you might with a big logistical problem or a business problem that's just too big to solve on its own, you break it down into steps, you think how you can go about tackling each part of the problem, and then you write the code necessary.
Can I just ask you a question
now? Yeah.
Because I find programs sometimes frustrating as a user, because you'll get so far into program and then in order to do the task, you click on something and open another window in the program. Like, for example, when I was a social worker and I had to click on set of safeguarding referral, then you get something like type of abuse, and you, instead of just bringing down a drop down, it opened another whole window where you had to tick a couple of things and select for a drop down, and then once you saved that, it went back to the main window. Is that because they've done it like that, or is it just
It might be because they've done it like that, but to be honest, it sounds more like an interface design problem.
Yeah.
In other words, you know, they've got a number of forms, yeah, and they've split them across different windows,
yeah,
whereas for you, it might have been easier if they just kept it all in the same window.
I'd say one of the examples would be, for instance, say, if you have got a situational question you're talking about, is somebody older, is it an older person you've got, and there may be a set of questions related to being an older person which somebody needs. If it's a junior person, they may have a different set of questions. So they tend to pop up and you say, what type of person am I dealing with? Yeah. Oh, it's an older, yeah, person. I'll, yeah, bring you up a set of, yeah, questions to deal with that.
But they and then just go back to the form, couldn't they? Surely they could just jump to the relevant questions.
Then you end up with a very long list of questions, possible questions, and that gets equally confusing.
Surely that's really about whoever's designed it.
It's the
system analyst to know. Sometimes the person using the system.
I've queried with program designers about this sort of thing, and they say, well, it's you can't really explain it, it's the nature of the program that we do it, we have to do it.
Well, there might be something about there may be something about the programming environment that forces them to do that, but it really sounds to me more like an interface design problem. And just briefly to talk about interface design, because that's a massive part of programming, what you have to do when you're designing an interface is to understand very intimately the task that the user is trying to perform, and then you design the interface to support that task as best you can. So from what you're saying, Adrian, is that the task you want to perform is one where you wouldn't be dropped into these different windows. And so, you know, it would have been a more appropriate design to maintain it all in one window and not drop out. But although it's analogous to these procedures, these separate programming blocks of code, procedural programming makes things easier for the human to solve the problem. And it's totally invisible. The user's no idea. It's going off and doing step one, step two, and step three. But when you're talking about the interface, then of course, you know, that does totally affect the user. And it's up to the interface designer to actually watch, well, to talk to the user and watch how they go about the task and how, you know, what documents they might need to reference and forms of what, you know, the way they go about it and design the interface to work as smoothly as possible.
I think one of the things that's often the case of what you find is interfaces are quite often designed by people who do not have visual impairment. Yeah. And then you'll suddenly discover that when you've got visual impairment, it doesn't work in the same way, and so people aren't necessarily taking that in part. Taking account of that when they're doing the design of their user interface.
Well, I take it further than that, because even if you're not visually impaired, they don't think about the end user. Somebody writing a piece of software for a client database for social workers doesn't have a clue about when you're a busy social worker and you're clicking through loads of things.
Yeah.
But actually, it's not very helpful to go onto a completely different screen to search somebody's address or whatever it is. If you're on somebody's on the phone, you're trying to writer of films. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's where I come back to this thing of actually watching somebody doing, because actually, if you just talk to them about how they do it, they'll describe it one way, but when you actually watch them do it, there'll probably be some differences in how they do that. So it's really important to do both. And actually to watch them doing a number of them, because there may be exception circumstances and so on. Okay, we need to get on to talk about specific programming languages finally. So there are literally hundreds of these general purpose programming languages and hundreds of scripting languages. And, you know, I could have obviously chosen any ones. I've actually decided to focus on five because between them, they give quite a good flavour, and they are definitely amongst the most popular programming or scripting languages. And some of them are also used for mobile development. And then when I've covered these five, we'll talk a bit about specifically mobile development, and finally come to accessible programming environments. Okay, so you will have heard, I'm sure, a good deal about Python. When I did the research for this, I was slightly surprised to find that Python isn't actually reckoned to be the most popular programming language currently worldwide. We'll come to that shortly. But it is nonetheless extremely popular for a number of reasons. It's a high level language, which means it's generally relatively straightforward to learn, relatively quick to learn. And for that reason, it's been introduced into quite a lot of university courses as the first programming language they teach. It's also general purpose. In other words, you can use it to write pretty much any kind of program, be it a web application, bit of scientific calculation. I'll come on to more applications in a moment, but basically you can write anything that you might want to program, you can pretty definitely program it in Python. The code, another reason it's popular is the code is fairly easy to read. You know, people, the whole kind of ethos of how you write a Python programming language is that you choose variable names which are meaningful. So when somebody else comes to read it, or you come to read it a week later, you understand what's going on. It's popular due to beginners because of its ease of learning, easy to use. Though the ease of use is a little bit of a drawback, because Python lets you get away with some things that some languages don't. And because of that, it's like it gives you some rope with which you can hang yourself. But by and large, it's a good thing. The freedom that the programming that Python gives you means that you don't have to over worry much about over fussy rules and compliance to things that really don't necessarily matter that much. It's used for a very wide range of applications. It's got a very active community, very well documented. It's relatively easy to set up, to install and set up. Another really big thing about Python is it's got a lot of supporting libraries. So if you want to do mathematical programming or scientific programming, or you want to manipulate data, do data analysis or statistical analysis, then it's got really very good libraries for doing that. So, you know, if for example, you wanted to calculate the mean and I'm going to choose obviously simple examples. If you wanted to calculate the mean and standard deviation of a set of numbers, you don't need to actually literally perform those calculations. There are built-in mechanisms for doing that. And that's true of many other much more sophisticated operations than sort of mean and standard deviation. if you want, and it's got really popular for data analytics because there's many built-in operations for doing quite sophisticated analysis of data.
Tony, can I jump in with a really primitive example?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So this is Darren. So this was some time ago. So take this not too literally, but about 10 years ago, I had a task where I was looking to try and get some information from a script running on a web server somewhere, and I know absolutely nothing about how web protocols work. I could not explain anything about HTTP or browsers, and the fact that I said HTTP rather than HTTPS shows you how old this example is. But with Python, I didn't need to know any of that, because there was, as you say, a library that had some functions that I could just say, get me this data from this site, and give me the result.
Yeah.
That's the level that I needed. You know, I didn't have to delve any further than that to be able to do what I needed to do.
Exactly. That's called web scraping. It's literally scraping data from the web. And it's got similar mechanisms for pulling data out of spreadsheets or databases. So, you know, these libraries save vast amounts of time. You know, in industry, I remember I was working at Rolls-Royce, and they set two of us a problem to solve. And my fellow sort of student sort of spent quite a long time, but produced a really nice original program to do the task. Whereas I came across a program written by somebody previously and essentially ripped that off and just tailored it slightly. And compared to, you know, in education and university, whereas the other student would have got all the credit, or should have certainly got all the credit, they said, no, good for you. You know, we don't want to pay you to do things that somebody else has already done. And that's an essential difference between education and industry. I've already touched on applications areas for Python, but briefly, data analysis, data doing stuff with databases, either updating them or even creating them. Well, yeah, NVDA is written in Python. Machine learning, so these large language models that we're going to be talking about tomorrow morning, for example, you could write one of those, or develop, I should say, one of those using Python. Rapid application development, in other words, if you want to knock up a prototype to show a client, yeah, we could do you a program that'll do this. So you can, Python's good for knocking that up quickly, showing them what the interface could look like, and then maybe changing it on the fly in front of them and saying, or it could look like this. So that's called rapid application development, and Python's very good for that. Okay, I'm going to move on because we're a little bit tight for time. What I should explain is I'm going to produce a document subsequent to this session which will have all of this in it and more, and references to books and the articles I've used to prepare this, and we'll release that within a week or two of Take a Break.
And those books and articles will be accessible, like, you can get them somewhere in the room.
I'm sorry, say that again?
The books and articles that you're inverting will be accessible.
Yeah, I mean, I got them off Google, doing fairly simple searches for the most part, and then I happen to know of a good book for introducing Python that's available on Audible. There's a couple of them. So, yeah, I'll give you all of that in the final document. Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, so I'm going to group a few together. Apologies, but I will make sure everything's in the final document. I'm going to group together Java, C, and C++. So they're other languages I was going to cover. They are relatively low-level programming languages. C is one of the older computer programming languages, and then C++ was developed to make programming a bit easier. And then Java was developed about 10 years after that in the 90s to make programming, again, a bit simpler and machine independent. So these languages are relatively hard to learn compared to Python. If you're, you know, maybe interested in doing computer programming as a hobby, my recommendation would very much either be to learn Python or JavaScript, which I'm going to talk about briefly, rather than one of these, C, C++, or Java. But C, C++, and Java are all heavily used in industry. C is known for being particularly low level. You need to actually understand something about the computer hardware you're using if you write in C. It's that low level. But because of that, it's very fast. So it's used in a lot of heavy engineering applications. C++ is similarly low level, but a little bit higher level, if you like, than C. And that's used in a lot of industrial applications and for gaming, movie special effects, and so on. Java is kind of the more modern version that's used, again, a lot in industry. Robust programming. Those languages, certainly C++ and Java, all enforce these kind of rules that we've talked about earlier that tend to ensure that there won't be silly mistakes occur in the program, that they tend to enforce the programmer to actually program correctly up to a point. I'm simplifying somewhat, but that's broadly the case. And then the next language I wanted to cover is JavaScript, which is in fact the most used programming language worldwide. As I said earlier, not to be confused with Java. It's totally different. It's a lot easier to learn than Java. It's very widely used for web development and database applications as well. It's really pretty much general purpose, rather like Python. So if you're interested in sort of dipping your toe into programming, or even actually having a career in programming, but you don't have masses of time to learn a new language, then my recommendation would be to definitely go for either Python or JavaScript. And really, it's pretty much your choice about you know, there are loads of jobs around in either of those once you get to a certain standard. One sad thing, actually, I should mention about Python, there's something around called Jupyter Notebooks, which is a way that people document their code, essentially. So the really nice thing from most people's points of view is that Jupyter Notebooks are a way of mixing the code and the English language description of that code. And actually, people publish scientific papers and include these Jupyter Notebooks on them because they're so good at documenting what the program does. The trouble is, Jupyter Notebooks don't currently work at all well with screen readers, which is a real blow. So none of that is to say that you can't program in Python. You can program perfectly fine in Python, but if you do much of it and end up sort of wanting to share it and read other people's code, sadly, very soon, you're going to run across people using these Jupyter Notebooks. And if you buy a book on Python, which has examples on the web or, you know, available for you to download, sadly, many of those examples are likely to be written in the form of Jupyter Notebooks, which will be hard to... There are, yeah, there most certainly are. And I can only think in the end they will be successful, but it's not trivial. But yeah, there is definitely active research in the States, for example, on that. And I will, if I can, I will include a reference to that in my final document. So the final language I'm going to just say a word or two about, which ironically it's the one I know most about, is SQL, which stands for Structured Query Language. I spent most of my career teaching about that. It's the language used for accessing and writing database applications and so on. My main point to say about that really is that it's a relatively easy language to learn. It's very widely used, but it's, you know, it's only used in conjunction with databases. So if you're looking to develop a career in programming, my advice would be, yes, SQL is an excellent language to learn, but it's probably not enough on its own. What employers look for is SQL plus JavaScript or SQL plus Python. Because that means you can do the database stuff, which is really important, but you can also write general purpose programming languages as well. Okay, of the languages I've covered, Python and JavaScript are the ones most widely used for mobile development, but there are other specific languages. So for example, if you're developing for the iPhone or the iPad, Apple promotes a language called Swift, which is very popular now for developing iPhone apps and iPad apps. On Android, there is a language called Kotlin, which came out in 2017, which Google very much promotes as the language to use. So you can use Java for Android app development, but the recommendation really these days would be to use Kotlin because it's simply easier to learn. Kotlin. Okay. Yeah, and it's easy to learn and it's kind of broadly Java compatible. You can convert Java code into Kotlin code, essentially. So finally, I said I'd talk about accessible programming environments. I'll be one more minute. Okay. So I'll try to include more about this in the document. There's not tons of information out there I found, but I can certainly do some more searching. But the word seems to be that there seems to be quite a consensus among visually impaired programmers that I found on the web that something called Visual Studio Code is the thing to use for, to be able to program accessibly, which is a bit of irony given the name, yeah. But you know, there did seem to be a decent measure of agreement between visually impaired programmers that was the environment to use. The other thing that people seem to use quite a bit is something called Notepad++, which is a kind of souped up version of Notepad, which is particularly friendly if you're developing code. So I'm sorry, I kind of messed up the timing of this a little bit, but we've covered quite a lot. There'll be more in the final document, particularly overviewed really the stuff about mobile programming and accessibility. So I'll definitely expand on those. We'll get that document out to you in the next few weeks. So thanks for the question.